Blog Talk Radio.
By my extreme co-host, Craig. What's going on, Craig?
Greetings and salutations, Edward. How are you this evening?
That wasn't very extreme, Craig. And we have our other co-host on the line, Couture. What's going on, Couture?
Not too much. What's going on?
Not too much. I'm pretty sure the music will be fine on the download, but kind of sounded kind of shitty
so.
On the phone there. So usually it works out all right. So, but anyway, so how's it going, Craig? You recovered from your illness that kept you off the Brian and Vinny show, or is it that you just didn't want to review British Boot Camp and you needed an excuse not to be on the show?
A little from column A and a little from column B. No, I almost didn't have a voice. It was that bad. So I'm still sniffling, and I'll probably hack a couple times during this conversation, but feeling better than Tuesday for sure.
Cool. And Couture, how's your week going?
It's going okay.
Going okay. Just a little cold, I guess.
I'm loving the weather. The weather down here has been pretty awesome, though. So.
Yeah, I like the cold, and it usually doesn't get this cold until like mid-December.
I know, it's like 35 degrees outside. Loving it.
Yes. It's awesome, except when you're drawing the newspaper in the middle of the morning with the windows open.
It was 17 degrees this morning when I left the house.
Wow. It's not that bad here, but
yeah.
Shit.
Yeah, that's what brought on the illness, I think, just the cold water.
Yeah. Well, we are doing a show. Basically, we are doing the history of ECW, and I guess that's inspired from the WWE Network doing their, what is it, the weekend
ECW?
ECW or ECW?
ECW? I said ICW, though, Papa promotion.
You said ICW? Oh, well, fuck, we fucked up this whole thing.
I got all these notes on Pez Watley. I kid. The show that ICW for about 5 minutes.
Well, isn't that the Papa promotion?
ICW, yeah.
Yeah, that's where they the guys. Then who was it Macho Man or somebody took a gun and pistol whipped Bill Dundee at like a washateria or something.
I think it was like a parking lot of a gym or something, and because they, you know, they were big enemies with they were out of Louisville and they were big enemies with the Memphis promotion. You know, Jerry Lawler and those guys, and they had some type. Sort of a confrontation in the parking lot of a gym or something, parking lot somewhere, and Gordon Dundee pulled out a gun. Randy Savage took it away from him and hit him in the face and broke his jaw with it.
Yeah,
that's embarrassing,
crazy,
isn't it? You pull a gun on somebody, take it away, and break your jaw with it. At least he didn't shoot him. Which
yeah,
is,
at least he didn't hurt his career.
If I was a Randy Savage, I would have been worried if Randy Savage was gone, so a broken jaw is probably the least thing that could happen to you, the least bad thing that could happen to you with it.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure he was all crazy on cocaine even back then, so. It would have been worse if he would have hit on his wife instead of took his gun.
That's true.
Yeah. But we are talking about ECW, so don't worry, it won't be all ICW tonight. So I'll use your idea, Katrina, so I'll let you introduce the show.
I think the first thing I remember is, I'm sure you guys were reading the old Aftermags like in the very early 90s, like around 92, 93. You remember the old Tri-State promotion out of Philadelphia?
Yeah, we mentioned it every once in a while. Weren't like the top stars like, let's see here. Tony Stetson, Johnny Hotbody, I think Sandman was just starting, maybe.
DC Drake, I think, was one of them. I know Woman was there.
Yeah, DC Drake, yeah.
I don't remember anybody else. The Rockin' Rebel, you remember him?
I remember him.
I remember he was in the early days of ECW. He was the victim of a rib. They were doing a battle royal for a title shot. And he was told he was going over. And then they went and told everybody in the battle royal when the battle royal starts to throw him over the top rope. So he was going over, but they just threw him over the top rope and they pulled a rib on him or something like that.
Did you ever see the Eddie Gilbert and Cactus Jack tape that was circulating around the 90s where they had this? It was like three different
matches.
Yeah.
That was what I think the promotion was most famous for at the time was the Eddie Gilbert Texas Jack series. I remember that. I was reading that all the time. And I think they had a match where I think at the start of the show they had, I can't remember exactly what it was. Maybe it was like a street fight, and then the second match they had maybe Falls Count Anywhere or something, and the third match was maybe with like a cage match or a barbed wire or something. I can't remember
no,
if
that
was
a cage match. Match.
There was a famous barbed wire one where he got like punctured like a whole bunch of times. But
I remember they had a barbed wire one where Cactus got his hair all tangled in the barbed wire. I think they had a kitten loose or something like that. But yeah, I remember those matches because they were
the thing about that show with the three matches on them is it had very bad ring psychology because, if I'm not mistaken, didn't Eddie Gilbert win all three? It's like, what's the point of having three matches if the same dude's going to win all three? You know what I mean?
I don't remember. I got my observer open from when they shut the promotion down. And as we go along here, I'll come across and see if I can find the results of that match. So
I'm pretty sure Eddie won all three.
That was
their big notoriety. That's what really got them. That's basically is the first time I heard about them, because that's when I remember reading about them, or at least the name caught my eye, because I remember reading about that series of matches, because they had like a bunch of pictures from them and there was some bloodbaths. And then didn't Eddie whack Cactus with like a bottle and it didn't break and he kept trying to hit him or something? Or he broke the bottle with his head?
I think like Cactus has been in matches, has been You know, many times the bottle that somebody tried to break and it was real.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I remember because they were having those big, like, I don't think it wasn't so much like it was a real regular promotion. I think they just had, like these big supercards, like, maybe 4 or 5 times a year. And they would have, like, these big cards, like they'd have, like, Eddie Gilbert against Cactus Jack, and they brought in, I know they brought in guys like Abdullah the Butcher and the Sheik a lot. And
yeah.
I remember one they had, they even brought in Iizuka from New Japan against Owen Hart. When Owen Hart was like...
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I remember
was,
that match.
Was pretty big,
that
was
match.
Pretty big worldwide internationally at the time. We went to WWF.
Yeah.
I remember those matches. And I believe the last card they had, the main event was scheduled to be the Battle of the Nature Boys, Buddy Landell against Buddy Rogers, who I think was 70 years old at the time, for the Tri-State Championship.
And he still would have had a better body than Buddy Landell.
Yeah, and they were also, I think they were also planning on this show to do a match that I don't know, I don't think ever happened. I'm not sure if these teams ever wrestled, but it was like Doc and Gordy was supposed to go against like Anderson LaFon on one of the shows.
I only remember them when they came in later.
That seems they were wrestling each other, because I was thinking about that, because they were both in All Japan, weren't they?
Yeah.
I don't recall them ever wrestling each other, though.
I don't think so.
For some reason. Which seems like I would remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Todd Gordon was involved in that Tri-State promotion, because he had a jewelry store or something. I think he was, I don't know if he was financing it or anything, maybe some of it, but just like all.
Well, it was him and like maybe two other people.
It was him and Joel Goodhart.
Yeah, I remember him. I remember that name.
There was somebody else that ran Tri-State. I didn't watch it all, but I watched like maybe half an hour of that the Jeremy Borash movie, ECW movie. And I'm pretty sure Bellini said somebody else was the owner of Tri-State, basically. But Todd kind of had a part. And basically, when Tri-State kind of went under, that's when Todd kind of went basically solo and started Eastern Championship Wrestling.
Yeah. And I think Goodhart, I think he ran out of money because they were putting on these shows, but they had a lot of name talent. I mean, aside from the guys that we had, you know, kind of the local guys we talked about earlier, they had a lot of name talent. Like, they bring in, like, the Sheik and Abdullah. Remember one time they brought
They'd bring in, like, Morocco Funk. And Kyo and people like that.
Yeah, and another
bring in
Terry Funk. They would do, like, Terry Funk and Jerry Lawler. I think one time they had Jerry Lawler and Honky Tonk Man or somebody like that wrestling. So, I think they just ran out of money. And I think the promoter, I think Goodhart, had all the money for the next show, for the Rogers versus Landell show, and he kind of disappeared with the money, like most promoters when he quit a business or when they just didn't
have
money.
What are you talking about? That's never happened before. I got to interject. Speaking of promoters and shit like that, there was a show in Mesquite, Texas, about a week or two ago. I think they were advertising it as like a Von Erich memorial thing. And they brought in Kevin and they brought in Ross and Marshall. And they wrestled the fucking American Wolves. They brought in Christopher Daniels and Kazarian. They brought in Angelina Love and Gail Kim. And trying to think if they brought in any more stars. But it wasn't, you know, you figure, okay, you're going to bring in these guys. Let's have maybe two or three just local matches. No, they had 50 other workers besides those guys on the show.
Mm.
Like Rudy Boy Gonzalez was on the show. And Gorilla Ken Johnson was on the show. Anyway, they had the show. Maybe 45 people showed up. Basically, I guess right after the show, the promoter paid Kevin and his sons and paid Davey and Eddie. Of course, you better pay Davey or hell is going to break loose. But they paid Gail and Angelina. They may have paid one or two other people of the indie crew, but basically at least, at the very least, 41 guys did not get paid after they had to sit there and wait 2 hours. And they didn't get paid after all. And I could tell, like, Rudy was pissed, but he wasn't going too crazy. There was another guy on my Facebook. I think he was one of the champions of that promotion. And this dude just went fucking insane ranting on Facebook after. So, yeah, it was that was like a he didn't the promoter didn't did like totally disappear, but I'm surprised he didn't considering how much money he owed to the board. I think it wasn't 41 wrestlers, it was almost 50 wrestlers. It was $41,000 they lost on the show.
Jeez.
How do you throw an indie show for that much money? You know what I mean? It's an indie show. You can't put that much money into it. I mean, geez.
Indie promoters seem to be, like, from all the years and the stuff I've read, they're pretty susceptible to heart attacks because most of them run off with the money and blame it on a heart attack or something like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Or
yeah, I saw something on YouTube. I think it was I don't know if it was this show or something recently. I saw some. It was a match with Kevin's two sons or something, like an independent match or something. I didn't look at it. Have you seen them wrestle? Are they any good?
I've never seen them actually wrestle. I've only just seen like pictures of them, and I know they kind of like got seen. It seems like the first time I heard about them, they were already in all Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So. I hear they're okay, but, you know, I hear they're still a little green, which is understandable. They've only been doing it for, what, a year or two?
But, yeah, the ECW, that came out of it's funny because, you know, like the big promotions, like the last 30 years have all come out of the demise of another promotion, Philadelphia, because, you know, ROH came about directly because of the demise of ECW.
Kinda.
Well, it did.
But well, actually, you could say many. You can say ROH took off from the technical side of ECW, and CZW took off from the hardcore part of ECW, and Chikara might have taken off from the wacky part of ECW. You know what
well,
I mean?
It
wasn't just more
because,
of ECW.
It was a direct result because you know. Rob Feinstein was the one doing all the videotapes for ECW back in the day, back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had to have, and they came up with that, him and, like, I think it was Doug Gentry and Gabe Spogel came up with that because they had that, something was missing there with ECW being gone. They didn't have that money or that income anymore. So they decided to put the ROH together, so, in 2002. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. But when it was Eastern Championship Wrestling, I think on the very first show that was – well, basically the way it became Eastern, I guess we got to talk about that because that's actually a major fucking deal is before it became Eastern Championship Wrestling, basically there was this big tournament in the Northwest.
Before
involving
it became
a lot.
Extreme Championship Wrestling.
Okay, yeah. I'm fucking everything up here. Well, let's talk about Eastern. When it was Eastern – Championship Wrestling, they were trying to get it on TV, so they were trying to make a pilot. So Todd Warden brought in Eddie Gilbert to do the TV, and Eddie Gilbert did the pilot. And I think he did it for maybe 6 months, somewhere around there. It wasn't a very long time, but basically he kind of just put the foundation together for everything. And I don't know how much it was really getting over because he was trying to do it like a Memphis style. And you know they were more of an asshole style up north. So basically, he brought in Paul Lee to help him out, help the guys with promos, and basically to help out as his buddy. And then over that 6 months, Eddie and Todd had a falling out. Then Eddie and Heyman had a bit of I don't even know how much of a falling out it was. We'd have to ask like Misty.
It was a pretty big falling out because I don't think they were like best of friends before that for years. And they never were after that. So.
Yeah. So then, like, somebody left. So then Paul basically took over Eddie's responsibilities and kind of took it over. And they did their first show, and I think the main event wasn't, like, the main event, Public Enemy, and it was their first appearance, and they beat established teams like Bad Breed, I think, and that kind of like started the Eastern Championship Wrestling, or was that not until the ECW part of it?
So Eastern, that was like the first thing that started was Eastern with Eddie Gilbert when he first came in. And I'm trying to remember. I remember they had guys like, they had Stan Hansen in sometime, and Kevin Sullivan, and Abdullah, and Eddie Gilbert, and Tito Santana, and Don Morocco, and Jimmy Snuka, and Terry Funk was there. Anyway, that's when I first remember, and then Shane Douglas came in, and yeah, Eddie Gilbert, he brought Paul Lee in as a manager, and I can't remember exactly what the real falling out was, but I guess it was just a disagreement. Oh, I don't know, Eddie Gilbert, he would like walk out of Memphis.
He had a lot of times he would
have fallen out, especially when he was in Memphis. He'd walk out like 4 or 5 times a year and always go back.
It's interesting to see.
If he would have lived, I would have liked to have seen his influence on wrestling, like in later years. I think he would have had a pretty big one, you know.
Yeah.
Especially maybe.
Yeah. To me, he was an earlier version, maybe kind of a Brian Pillman, kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest with you, like Eastern, it was to be honest with you, they did bring in these people, but for the most part, it was just there. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. there was nothing super. It wasn't important. It didn't become important until they became Extreme Championship Wrestling. And basically how that came about is the NWA, Eastern Championship Wrestling was part of the NWA. And Dennis Corluzzo, is that his name? He was the in charge, one of the main guys of the NWA. And they're having the tournament for the new NWA champion. And I think they actually had some pretty...
ECW was the only member that had television at the time that was in the NWA, NWA wasn't anything back then at that point, so, you know. ECW was the only member that had television time, so that's why they did the tournament there.
Yeah, so they're doing the thing on TV, and they got Gordon, and they got Carluzzo in the front row. And basically, it comes down to Shane Douglas versus Flash Funk, or Too Close Scorpio at the time. And Shane wins the match, and they give him the belt, and he starts to cut this promo about the Dusty Rhodes and the Ric Flairs and the Ricky Steamboats. And I remember someone screams, "Carry Von Erich!" And he goes into "Carry Von Erich!" And then like he says something like that, "This is for you." And he says, "They can all kiss my ass," and he throws the title down. So everyone's kind of like everyone in the back stripping because they know that wasn't supposed to happen. And Carluzzo's there in the front row looking at Shane. He'll look at Gordon. He looks back at Shane. He's biting his fingernails. And then he's like, "Hey, man, he's shitting on the belt." And Gordon's like, no, just see what he has to say. He's like, "No, man, he's shitting on the belt." And he's like, no, it's an angle. And so basically... the Carluzzo's like, "What the fuck?" And he's like, look, this is what you do. It's an angle. You just go on TV. You say you're going to suspend him or you're going to, like, strip him of the title if he doesn't defend and he has to defend and so. So they even got Carluzzo to cut fucking promos for the fucking show the next week.
It would be like if Vince McMahon got Bret Hart to cut a promo at, like, the day after Montreal or something like that. You know?
So the night of Montreal. Yeah. So then to come the next Tuesday when the TV airs, basically the way Todd Gordon put it was, he found out that he got pumped. And basically that's what started. And Shane had grabbed the ECW title and held it up, and that's where he proclaimed it, the Extreme Championship Wrestling title.
Yeah, and that's really where they took off and, you know, and first made their name doing that, which is the NWA. I mean, like I said, at that point, it was nothing. I mean, the NWA to me was 1985, Dusty Rhodes, Ric Flair, Four Horsemen, and stuff like that. It wasn't Too Cold Scorpio and Shane Douglas and, you know, stuff like that. I don't know. Yeah, he threw the title down, and was funny was, like, they were trying to figure out who they wanted to make the champion. And Gordon, because Douglas was the ECW champion, he said he wanted to make him the champion just to help their own organization. And I think Jim Crockett was involved. And Corluzzo had voted for Chris Benoit to be the champion. And Gordon didn't want that. And he got outvoted by Jim Crockett because, quote, Jim Crockett did not know who Chris Benoit was at the time, 1994. Huh. Which shows you how out of touch he was.
Now regarding that Jeremy Borash movie I was watching earlier, basically everyone kind of had like a different opinion on how it went down. Like Joey Styles is like, he's talking about how Heyman's like, oh, it's a classic double cross and this and that, and he's like, the problem is you lied, and that's, you know, in court that's. You know, I forget what he said, but basically he's like, I just didn't like it. And then I think Raven said something like, yeah, it was the right thing to do business-wise, but I don't know if it was the right thing to do karmically-wise. And then Terry Funk, being an NWA champion, he wasn't really all that happy with it. So, well, Craig, what were your thoughts on this whole situation?
Well, obviously, I didn't see it till years later. I've never, I think I got into ECW probably, I'm going to say around 96. So this was like 2 years after the fact. And I never thought a lot about Shane Douglas, to be honest with you. I didn't like him when he was in WCW. He just didn't do, you know, anything for me. He didn't move the needle. And when I saw the angle, you know, years later, I thought it was pretty ingenious. In fact, it was one of those angles that you're like, why don't other organizations pick up on this and just flat out copy it? Because it's a great angle. It's a great angle. And nobody seems to do an invasion or a takeover correctly. I mean... Vince screwed it up to a royal degree. So
WCW did get it right for about a year.
Yes, for a while. But a way to kick off a new promotion, it got a lot of buzz, and that's exactly what they were looking for. And if you piss off the NWA, I know that that even Michelle Starr up in Canada is an NWA affiliate. And at the time, they switched over to something called ECCW, Extreme Canadian Championship Wrestling.
Yeah, I remember those initials.
Yeah. So it was a big deal, and it was a cool deal. And it's something that, like I said, people just I think it can be used more. If you know what I mean.
Yeah, I like Shane, like you were talking about Shane Douglas. I like him, I really like him and Ricky Steamboat as a team. I don't know if you guys remember when they teamed together.
Yeah, they were awesome. They were actually awesome.
In WCW. But when they became a deal, he really... Say what now?
I was going to say, but I love them as a team, but I knew it was the Z-Man under the mask and not Shane Douglas during that cage match.
Yeah. It's a cage match.
Yeah.
It seemed they took the mask off so he could show he wouldn't want to get beat.
He didn't have to do that. We all knew he wasn't the one that got beat.
Yeah, I know.
Let me interrupt the conversation because we do have a caller on the line who's been on hold for a while. He's jumping a gun because I'm sure he wanted to call and talk about when the Luchas took over ECW. So let's go to caller from calling. Are you 619? And what's going on, Rey Mysterio?
Hey, what's going on? Hey, listen.
God damn it, Alex.
I'm very offended. This is Alex Goff. I'm very offended you did not consult with me before you did the show because I'm a de facto ECW historian. That is a fact. And I'm very offended that you didn't consult with me prior to this show. The comment was made that Eddie Gilbert was Brian Pillman. I mean, that was borderline offensive. Brian Pillman was an incredible talent. Ahead of his time talent, really. I mean, if you go back and watch the match with Liger specifically, but other matches, I mean, he was doing things that a lot of the Ring of Honor guys today emulate as far as style and pacing. But Eddie Gilbert, Paul Heyman, of course, you know, got started in the business as a photographer in WWF. And he was backstage at all those shows taking pictures and was able to learn. But when he was young, his formative years, he was spent traveling with Eddie Gilbert and Missy Hyatt. And he rode the roads with him in Continental and learned how to book from Eddie Gilbert, learned his philosophy of professional wrestling out of Eddie Gilbert. And I believe that Eddie Gilbert, while he had a very tragic passing, Eddie Gilbert's influence is felt in the business even today. I think people as far as CM Punk can credit some of his success later in his career to Eddie Gilbert's thoughts, because, I mean, that's what built Heyman during his formative years. And even though Heyman's evolved himself and definitely picked up more influence, Heyman's an incredibly intelligent guy. The guy who crafted him when he was, you know, a young man was Eddie Gilbert. I mean, at one point, I believe they were all three living together. A few years ago, Missy Hyatt sent me this incredible piece she had written about the time all three of them were together and her thoughts on everything. And I believe she went into her thoughts on the early days of ECW, why Eddie may have left. At that time, she wasn't with Eddie. Eddie was with Medusa at that time. But, you know, Eddie was a very fascinating character and unfortunately not given enough credit character in the history of professional wrestling, specifically because he influenced Paul Heyman so much.
I also think that Eddie Gilbert, he learned a lot from, like, Lawler and Jerry, but I also think he learned a lot from working with Bill Watts, you know, as booker in UWF, and that was some of the style that, kind of like that Memphis style of booking, you know, that kind of soap opera style. I think he learned a lot from Bill Watts, too.
See, you guys are all wrong. He learned the most when he was a protege of Bob Backlund and WWF, and that's where he learned
all
his
boring.
And we talked about all the events surrounding the Shane Douglas throwing down the title, but also during that time in ECW television, Eastern Championship Wrestling is kind of defined by the time that Eddie Gilbert was there, and it wasn't really high-profile stuff. Like Craig said earlier, you know, he started watching in 96, and that was about the time I started watching as well. But if you go back and watch those televisions, specifically the Public Enemy build, and especially during that time where they were having the NWA title tournament on television, they had an incredible feud between Cactus Jack, Terry Funk, and the Public Enemy, which led to a match around that same time where it was Cactus Jack, Terry Funk against the Public Enemy. I believe it was the same weekend as the NWA title tournament because it aired during the same time on the television.
Might have been the same
and what happened was the Public Enemy took out Terry Funk. So Cactus Jack was without a partner. Who would Cactus Jack rely on next? Tommy Dreamer, the Public Enemy, took him out. There was literally nobody in the ECW arena for Cactus Jack to team up against in his World Tag Team title match against the Public Enemy. And Cactus Jack was the last guy on the roster, the loser, Mikey Whipwreck. And in an incredible angle, the ECW arena went wild the night that Cactus Jack and Mikey Whipwreck beat the Public Enemy for the tag team titles, which Paul Heyman booked the Public Enemy incredibly intelligently. One of their first feuds was against Bad Company, which is an all-time underrated tag team, Pat Tanaka and Paul Diamond. You know, they have still one of my favorite matches of all time when they wrestled the Rockers at the Royal Rumble. I believe it was 91 or 92 as the Orient Express. And they completely killed it at Eden.
Wait. Was it not Paul Diamond or was it a Kino? Wait, not a Kino. What the hell was his match? It was Tanaka, but wasn't it the Japanese guy and not Paul Diamond?
I believe it was Paul Diamond. I believe
Paul
they
Diamond
were the Orient Express.
I believe
it was.
You're thinking of Kiyo Sato in the first incarnation of the Orient Express in 1990. You know, before
I remember them beating the Rockers at one of the pay-per-views.
Tenru and someone else beat the Rockers at the... I think at WrestleMania, I believe.
It was Tenru and Kitao beat Demolition at WrestleMania.
Demolition, yes, correct.
And it was Akito Sato who was with Hakushi. Remember, he was Shinja during that, in like 1995, when Hakushi came in, he managed him, and then he left, and Paul Diamond came in under the mask, which made the team improve tremendously. So,
yeah. What the hell is Paul Damon's name? Oh, Kato, right?
Kato, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember the Public Enemy Terry Funk Hayden's Jack thing. Wasn't there a spot where, like, Rucker Rock was, like, hogtied by his ankles and hanging over the balcony or something?
That happened in Hardcore Heaven 94. It was one of those shows in 94. I think it was Hardcore Heaven, but, yeah, there was a – before Cactus had come in, the Public Enemy – or maybe it was after. Public Enemy had been feuding with the Funk Brothers, Dory and Terry.
Yeah.
And, right. And that was – and Heyman booked the Public Enemy incredibly well because he brought in wrestlers who could wrestle with the Public Enemy because, as we saw later – the Public Enemy kind of got exposed, and then Vince McMahon later in their career, you know, brought him in and never brought him in. But, you know, the Public Enemy were put in with really good wrestlers while they're in ECW and made them look great. And Paul Heyman always said that, you know, the fact that Public Enemy got a big contract with WCW was based on his intelligent booking of them.
That's true. And they were a team that also they were one of those acts that I don't think anybody that never saw, like, ECW could understand how big they were. Like, when they – if they just saw them, like, in WCW, you really couldn't understand what they were all about, because it was just that atmosphere at ECW, you know, like, with the fans and the music and stuff like that, they really brought everything out in them, so –
to me, that's all they were, though, because I honestly never ever got that much of the Public Enemy as a tag team at all. But
saw them as like no WCW, so, and they didn't have much to work with there, so, you know, they had to tone their style down a little bit, so.
And also, Paul Heyman, that was his first real use of the hip-hop music videos that he would become famous for later. I remember Onyx Slam was one of the songs associated with Public Enemy. Also, there was a few other songs. I can't remember off the top of my head. I know that he did a video for Mr. Hughes, too, to MC Light's Roughneck. But, you know, he would incorporate these hip-hop videos, and it would give the ECW wrestlers during that time and even later a certain edge because they were embracing hip-hop as compared to, you know, WCW and WWF at the time, which were embracing you know, just total mainstream kind of hokey stuff. And in 96, that's kind of what definitely edged them out to me, definitely, is because they were edgier than what was presented on weekly television. So the hip-hop videos had a lot to do. Public Enemy had an image of – this was 1992, right? So on mainstream television, I mean, the edgiest wrestlers you had were – I mean, who were some of the edgier wrestlers on WWF and WCW television? I mean,
nope.
Undertaker, you know? So Public Enemy, while later they looked incredibly tame, especially when they brought the gangsters in 95, because the gangsters were completely out of control, Mustafa and especially New Jack. But, yeah, Public Enemy at that time kind of had that edginess, and they were, you know, incorporating the tables and the hip-hop and taking dudes out. Like I said, I mean, they took out Dreamer and Funk on the same evening, you know, and it was pretty crazy.
Yeah, I remember
one thing
back then. One of the things that like when I first got a chance to see CW was like in 96. I think I discovered, like most people, I was like up at 3 o'clock in the morning flipping channels and came across a channel I didn't actually know that I had. It was like the Prime Network or something like that, and I seen like Brian Lee chokeslam and Tommy Dreamer off of the Eagles Nest in the ECW arena. But one thing that stuck out to me, that stuck out on like the TV show that had been missing for years from like the mainstream wrestling, like WCW or WWF, was actual real music, you know?
Yes.
It wasn't the in-studio, you know, the in-house stuff they produced, you know, just because they didn't have to pay for it or anything. I guess you should ever use it because they flew so far under the radar it didn't matter at the time. but just like the music, like I thought for Tommy Dreamer coming out to Man in the Box or Raven coming out to Offspring.
It was like a throwback to World Class and Mid South, you know, having to get some rock and roll songs.
With that and especially with like it was like a throwback to like Memphis with the music videos and stuff like that. It was awesome.
And it, And maybe Craig can elaborate on this as well, but especially in that 94, 95, 96 time frame, you know, hip-hop and rock, grunge-type music, I mean, that was definitely the counterculture stuff. I mean, Paul Heyman was playing Smashing Pumpkins, you know, some of their early albums, and, you know, Pearl Jam, and, you know, definitely, you know, like the hip-hop artists like Onyx and MC Light. And, I mean, Heyman not only was playing – like Couture said, you know, different music than what you were seeing on, you know, just your stock music. But he was playing music that was kind of counterculture music, kind of against the mainstream, which is almost something like you couldn't even do today, because what music has changed so much. Like, what would you even play today that would be in that same vein, you know?
I guess the big thing is we were... We were used to the cartoon that had become the WWE, and when they brought something that was actually real, so they were actually playing music that we listened to. I remember the one that stuck out to me. It was a band that was an offshoot of Pearl Jam, and the band is called Mad Season, and Paul used this song called I Don't Know Anything, and he put it to a montage of the Eliminators just laying waste to people. And it was just this really heavy, heavy song. It was almost like a music video with that starred the Eliminators just destroying people. And that's something that it was so unusual. And it was mainstream, but it wasn't mainstream for wrestling. You know, because, I mean, God bless Jimmy Hart, but he's old. And when he was writing the WWE music and you had the, you know, Real American and all that, I just, it just spoke to you because, okay, this is hip, this is cool, this is different. And... it didn't seem like you were watching cartoons.
Yeah.
And Heyman always understood, and especially later after the UFC emerged, right? And you can definitely notice this when he started booking Taz especially. But in 95 and 96, he started promoting the big fights, right? So 96 was the first year I started watching ECW. The big fights that year were the confrontations between the Eliminators and the Gangsters. Building toward the Sabu-Taz match. You also had Rob Van Dam Sabu that was a hot feud in 96 as well. You also had, you know, at the end of the year, you had Tommy Dreamer and Shane Douglas confrontations along with Brian Lee, along with Pitbull number two. You also had Sandman and Raven. So I really get frustrated, and I did a podcast about a month ago, I believe, with Todd Martin, where I discussed this with him. I get tired of the trope that's always thrown out that ECW was hardcore, and that's what the learning point was from the history of ECW. It was more than the fact that they incorporated that, which at the time it was necessary to really break them out from what the other companies were doing. But it was always – and this is what's missing today in a lot of professional wrestling, and really UFC is kind of getting away from it too, is the big fight, right? We all want to see the big fight. And Heyman, I think, better than anyone knew how to properly promote and how to properly put together the big fight. The reason why I stayed watching ECW is because in 1996, I saw Tommy Dreamer, and he said he was going to kill Brian Lee at Heatwave 96 because he had chokeslammed him through three tables. And I was sold. And then they brought in Terry Gordy, and he said he wanted to kill Raven. And Sandman wanted to kill Raven as well, and he wanted to beat up Stevie Richards just because he was there, and I wanted to see that. And throughout that television, they told me, this is the big fight. And Shane Douglas also had something to prove against three other men, Pitbull number two, Chris Jericho, and Too Cold Scorpio. And this is not about the WWE Network, but this stuff obviously aired on the network. And I'll say, you know, everyone's like, how do you fix the network? Put on some big fights, and people will buy that network. You put the big fight on the network, and people will buy it. That's the problem, that World Wrestling Entertainment has got so far away from just that simple concept of this Sunday night, we got the big fight. These two guys you've been waiting to see, we put them together. And, you know, it's just kind of, you know, there was this phase, and I see it now with New Japan a lot, you know, where it's like, oh, we want to see the good match. You know, these two guys are going to have the good match. Well, I'm a guy who wants to see the big fight. I think there's a lot of guys out there like me who wants to see the big fight. And, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, WWE, it seems like they, it's like, they seem to get it right like once a year around WrestleMania, you know, promoting the big fight. But just like the other 11 months out of the year, it's just like nothing to them anymore. So, I don't know.
Well, let's get off WWE because this isn't about WWE. But you kind of mentioned earlier about how ECW was the first hardcore promotion, and Paulie Dangerous deserves a lot of credit for pulling the wool over a bunch of people's eyes. So that is the fucking most bullshittedest fucking thing that I've ever fucking heard. ECW being the first hardcore wrestling promotion. You can go back and watch any episode of Southwest Wrestling, and you will see some hardcore shit. You can watch any Puerto Rico from any year from today, from 40 years ago. You'll see some fucking hardcore-ass wrestling. ECW was not the first hardcore wrestling, but Paul Lee convinced everybody that it was. He got everyone drinking the Kool-Aid and gave ECW this aura about themselves that they were this totally different first-ever hardcore. That's fucking bullshit. That they were maybe the last hardcore organization, you know. But he does deserve so much credit for that. Paulie also deserves a lot of credit for evolving his characters, because we all know how badass Taz was. When Taz got to ECW, he was a half fucking, half Samoan, half Jimmy Superfly Snuka wannabe. Tommy Dreamer was some pretty boy wannabe wearing fucking suspenders. The Sandman was wearing a goddamn wetsuit for some fucking reason. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He evolved them until they became the icons of ECW that they are and who everyone associates them with. But they were all totally different when they got there. And he's so great. He turned 911 into like this giant feared monster for like a very long time. And all he could ever do was chokeslam people. You know, like I say, Public Enemy. You know, Rocco Rock, he wasn't that. Johnny Grunge, he sucked.
He was horrible.
I hate to say it. He was horrible. They weren't that great. He turned him into this legend while they were there until they got exposed elsewhere. You know, he gave New Jack a place to perform to where it was the only place New Jack was ever going to be able to do that shit. You know, he tried it in Smoky Mountain. He got kicked out, basically, because he was just too far, you know, for the mainstream. But, you know, Paulie, basically to me, ECW, I mean, there were some great athletes and they had great matches, but you talk about one person being deserving the credit, almost 99% of the credit for that organization, it's all Paulie.
I don't agree with your assessment of the gangsters running Smoky Mountain. They left Smoky Mountain because they weren't drawing anymore and because Jim Cornette's booking, more so than they couldn't get away with what they were doing.
I thought the white folks chased them out.
That was part of it.
That's what I meant. They couldn't do that stuff in Smoky Mountain where they could do it in ECW.
It's amazing he stayed employed for so long, New Jack, anywhere. Especially ECW.
But I don't know what Cornette, you know, Cornette was running those southern towns. And listen, I am the biggest Jim Cornette fan I think you'll ever find. But, you know, he brought the gangsters to those towns as that, you know, the black militant movement, post, you know, Rodney King, and, he got what any rational person thinks he would get. You know, he got a lot of backlash. He got a lot of people who quit watching his television, and, you know, he got, and when the fans that showed up, they wanted a piece of the two black guys.
Craig, your thoughts on Paul Heyman, since you're being quiet?
I think the best thing about Paul is, and I think somebody mentioned it earlier, it's that he found the thing that they were good at, and he would emphasize their strengths. So, Nightmare 1 was a huge, tall man. And so, what he wouldn't do was have people beat him or beat him down. The Public Enemy were a great act. They were not a great wrestling team. So he made sure to emphasize their strengths. What were their strengths? Well, they could entertain a crowd. So he let them entertain a crowd. They didn't ever chain wrestle. They didn't ever, you know, have, you know, they never went like an hour. You know what I mean? He kept them in segments that they could do. He never went out and exposed them. With Taz, this man, I hope he will never listen to this because Brian got heat over this a long time ago. Taz is a midget. but he was 9 feet tall in the ring. And it's because they protected him, and it's because the way they booked him. And Paulie, for that, is a genius. And when you can take normal guys, like, God bless him, Mikey Whipwreck, and turn him into the underdog that everybody cheers for and make him champion and have it believable, that's a great booker.
During the NWA title tournament, they debuted a character called Born Again, which was Matt Bourne playing a new character where he at first was playing Doink and then kicked into Matt Bourne basically was Issues is what it looked like it was going to become. He was going to be a protege with Shane Douglas and Mr. Hughes. And I know, Craig, you're very familiar with Matt Bourne being from that area. But what had Matt Bourne done in like 6 years prior to him being in ECW was talk. Before that, he had been Big Josh in WCW. After that, he had been Doink, and he was incredible as Doink in WWF, but he had not been allowed to cut promos. And if you go back and watch Matt Bourne in the 80s, Matt Bourne was an incredible promo and an incredible wrestler, and Heyman allowed him to do those two things for the short period of time he was there. But he was able to capture, you know, what was good about most people. You know, later in the late 90s, Vince, when he couldn't figure out what to do with someone, most famously Al Snow, he would send them down to Paul, and Paul would figure it out. That's an incredible talent.
First off, that was a mistake, because Al already had the greatest gimmick of all time in Avatar, and if they would have just gave that a little time, it would have took off, and he'd be the John Cena, you know, like John Cena.
Oh, please.
What's the greatest match in pro wrestling history? It is the match between Andre and Hulk Hogan.
The best match on that show. Fuck off.
The famous Al Snow rant.
That was
so,
honestly though, that was like you know, I remember Al Snow from fucking Avatar and fucking Lee Cassidy, right? And then he went to, cause first, me personally, I really followed ECW through the aftermags for the longest time. I remember one time, like, maybe Entertainment Tonight or one of those, like, Hollywood news shows had, like, a piece on this Extreme product. And I remember seeing Shane Douglas, and I was like, yeah, he was a school teacher, like, a couple months ago. And now he's talking all crazy, like, they do all this crazy stuff. But I honestly didn't see ECW until the first pay-per-view, which I didn't even see the first pay-per-view. I just saw the thing that they did with Raw, like, the little Raw invasion where Sabu fell off the Raw letters, and luckily those guys kind of caught him. And, you know, they had, like, Dreamer and Devon and Big Stevie Cool and a few other people, and that was, like, my first exposure to them. And then I really didn't see them again until the second pay-per-view. That's the first pay-per-view that I saw and stuff. And, you know, they actually, I think that them being on Raw really, I don't think that, people give the WWE as much credit for helping ECW as much as possible, because that was their biggest exposure they ever got all fucking time, no matter their whole run. You know, that was, more people saw them or heard of them from that. So, and I don't hear people give WWE any credit for that. But to me, that's what really hooked me, was that time period. And then after I saw that first pay-per-view, because it was so different. And then the pay-per-view was good because it wasn't just all hardcore. I mean, the first match, I can't remember who started the match, but basically it turned into a tag team between Jerry Lynn, Tommy Rogers against Chris Candido and Lance Storm.
That
was fucking awesome.
This is November Remember 98. That's November Remember 97. That's the third pay-per-view. Hardcore Heaven was
the
second. Fair Legal
was
the
second.
Yeah,
that was the
second
one for some reason.
Shane Douglas.
Okay, well, that was the first one that I saw live. Well, not live, but the first one I saw in its entirety. That's also the one where they have like a bunch of like a tag team tornado match, and that's where Tommy Rich danced it. He got hit in the head with a guitar by New Jack, and gigged and did a jig as he was started bleeding just profusely from the head, and he jigged until he finally fell down. And that was fucking like that was awesome. And,
I remember I remember the first time I saw ECW and WWE. You remember when they showed up at that In Your House in Philadelphia at Mind Games?
Yeah,
yes.
Didn't the Sandman spit or he did something to, like, JBL or something?
JBL and Bobby Vega during a strap match.
Yeah, it was Paulie and Tommy Dreamer and Sandman in the front row. And Sandman stands up and chugs a beer and then spits right in Savio's face. And I remember the next night on Raw, Taz jumped the railing with the Sabu Fierce Taz sign. And I remember I watched Livewire when Bruce from Connecticut called into Livewire that one time. And it was Paul E.
Yeah, I remember that.
I thought it was awesome. See, I didn't know that. Obviously I knew wrestling was a work, but I didn't know to what extent. Actually, these people hated each other back then. So I thought it was pretty cool.
I guess we should talk about some of our favorite matches. We've got about a half hour left, so.
Okay.
I think the one that sticks out to me the most was chain match with the Pitbulls.
Oh, Dog
and
Collar.
Raven.
Match.
Yeah, the Dog Collar. So, thank you. Dog Collar match with the Pitbulls and Raven and. And why is my mind going blank? Right, Stevie Richards.
Stevie Richards.
And that was like some of the first TV that I ever got from them. I was trading tapes with a guy from back east, and he sent me that first month of TV that he had taped for me, and that was the first thing I saw. And I remember sitting in a room full of grown men watching this. And we were losing our minds because we had never seen anything like it. And just the realism, the blood, the table after table after table. I just absolutely loved that match.
Is this the match where Raven took that fucking super bomb and hit his head on the corner of the table? You remember
that? Oh, yeah.
My God, that looked like hurt.
That was nasty. And it was stuff like that throughout the match. I mean, poor Stevie Richards, they crotched him on the guardrail. And you know how you can tell a guy, you know, catches himself? He didn't catch himself. And then they're just slamming him again and again and again on the guardrail. Early shades of Tommy Dreamer with the genital trauma. And God, that was such a great match. That was easily one of my favorites just because it was so amazing.
One of my favorite matches and the innings, it's actually weird when you think about it because there's one thing that like the ECW fans, they were pretty much all smart fans or smarks or whatever you want to call them. And this is when the internet was kind of first coming out. So this is when you really knew when somebody was leaving or not. So if they knew somebody was leaving, no matter who it was, I mean, they fucking chanted, "You sold out the Cactus Jack of all people." You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If you were leaving, you got the "you sold out" and they treated you like shit that whole match. You know, maybe at the very end they gave you an ovation, but they let you know that they weren't happy you were leaving. It was like, fuck you. You're leaving. Fuck you. But the one match to me that was so different was the Eddie Guerrero-Dean Malenko match because everybody knew it was their last match. you know, and they've had such an awesome series of matches. So they went out there, and like I say, at this time, everyone tries to remember ECW just being all hardcore, which they weren't. These guys had this incredible, incredible technical match. I mean, they had many of them, actually. And it just such an awesome, awesome match that even though they were leaving, the fans all, every single one of them at the end of the match, they weren't selling you sold out or booing them. They were all chanting, please don't go, please don't go. And that was actually made the match even more awesome because it was like you weren't expecting that after the match. You were expecting that, you know, the you sold out. And for some reason, just one match, these two guys, everyone had a totally different reaction to it than they normally would if somebody was leaving.
Yep.
Yeah, that's I mean, the other thing, like, when in, this is in 95, when, you know, aside from all the hardcore stuff you're hearing about, you're hearing about all these amazing matches with Monico and Guerrero. You know, we have, you can throw Benoit in there. You know, just that kind of mid-card, like, TV title spot. They were having, like, tremendous matches all the time. It was awesome.
And they'd also incorporated Malenko and Benoit as a tag team. And they had a feud with the Public Enemy and with Taz and Sabu, which led to the three-way dance. And then this was right around the time Sabu was leaving. And that was incredible as well. So, Malenko and Benoit as a tag team.
Yeah,
tag champion.
When he publicly fired him because he double-booked himself in ECW and Japan on the same night. So, and I remember that's when Rick Steiner came in and teamed with Taz for that one match, for that three-way dance. Yeah, I remember that. I remember one of the first matches, really, like, big matches that I saw, I think Alex brought up just a few minutes ago, was that big, I think it was the big four-way, and I think it was Heatway 96, it was Shane Douglas, Pitbull 2, Chris Jericho, and Too Cold Scorpio in the four corners match. Yeah, I thought that was an awesome match. I thought Too Cold Scorpio was one. I thought he was a little bit underrated. I thought he was phenomenal.
Yeah,
he was great too. He started getting a little fat.
He just did a lot of the half line stuff though when he was big. He'd get up to like 245 or 250 or something, and still doing all that stuff. You know, I thought he was tremendous. And that was the first time I saw Chris Jericho, and actually the first time I saw a Pitbull. And one thing I liked about ECW back then was I never saw any disqualifications or anything.
Right.
It's like every match, it seems like anything goes. It's like it was weird because when they said they're having like Sabu and Van Damme against Eliminators and all the, and you can use, and ladders are legal, said like it wouldn't be legal otherwise.
But
like
the whole gimmick was they
just like anything goes
the
in every match.
In every match, basically.
Yeah, and it was like anything goes in like every match, and there was really no rules, and which I enjoyed. So.
Yeah. And you remember the match where Cactus Jack went and got a frying pan from someone in the audience and smacked the Sandman with it, and it was a real fucking frying pan, and he gave him a concussion.
He
forgot what he was doing, and he kept kicking out of every fucking pinfall attempt, and the match just wouldn't end for the longest time until Cactus finally just killed him.
I think it might have been a Texas death match, and he kept on getting up when he's supposed to stay down or something like that.
No, he kept kicking out. I've seen the match on the DVD.
It was a Texas death match, yeah. You guys are both correct. Yeah, Sandman was supposed to stay down, and then he could get up by the count of 10. But instead,
he was just kicking
out the pinfall. Yeah. my favorite match wasn't necessarily the best match in ECW history, but it was Sabu-Taz for all the reasons I stated earlier.
Yeah.
Sabu-Taz had the best build of any match I can remember. I can really remember. I mean, better than a lot of UFC fights. I think the only UFC fight I looked more forward to was maybe the Chael Anderson Silva rematch. I mean, Taz and Sabu told a wonderful story for over a year. And, you know, people try to pick out dynamics of it, of why it worked. But it worked because of everything. It worked because they didn't touch. It worked because Sabu didn't talk in a strange way, because it made it almost more you know, your mind had to fill in the blanks as to what Sabu was thinking and what he was going to do when he got his hands on Taz. And we kept referring to 911. One of 911's last moments in the company was actually getting choked out by Taz at Heatwave 96.
Yep.
So that build to that match was incredible. And, you know, in the after thing, you know, Taz was, I would consider him the one, you know, if Raven was the 1A heel in the company, Taz was 1B. You know, Taz got a lot of television time. And after that, Taz became the number one baby face in the company right after that match and led them to the next era of the company, which they got a lot more exposure.
Mm-hmm. I think going back to Sabu is, you know, I didn't see Sabu until, like I say, until I started watching, like, from the third pay-per-view on, but I was watching, like, I watched that documentary earlier with Jimmy Borash, and it's actually the first time I think I've ever heard Sabu talk in, like, the when he's talking in that thing, and he's talking about when he first came in. And he said that, like, he had talked to Paul and Paul was like, how about we do this thing, Hannibal Lecter, you're tied down and you're wearing Hannibal Lecter mask. And he said sure, because he just thought he was fucking with him and he didn't think he was serious. And then he goes to the show and they hand him a fucking mask and he's, like, throwing it down. And he's like, no, we want you to do this. And he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. It's stupid. And then he said that basically came in, was like, I'll give you $500 if you just do it this one time. And he said he only really did it because I think Jim Crockett was in the audience. So he did it where they brought him in the gurney, and then they let him go, and then he just ran wild. And then the next show, he's like, okay, you're going to do it again? He's like, no, I'm not going to do it. He's like, I'll give you $500, and you never have to do it again. So he's like, all right. So we did it, and then, like, I guess he just ended up where he had to do it. He had to do it for a while until he just got tired of it, and then finally he stopped. But they would show footage of him, like, I guess they didn't actually have footage on this documentary, but I've seen it where, like, you know, they released him, and he just goes like his uncle. He just goes straight to the crowd, and people would start running from him. And he really built that aura around Sabu, like, right from the beginning.
He was, like, the hottest guy, like, out there, like, on the independent circuit at the time, like, in the early to mid-90s. I mean, he was the one guy that everybody was talking about, was Sabu, all the crazy stuff he was doing.
When they brought him into WCW, they attempted to do the same thing, but it just did, some of that stuff didn't work at the larger company, and he ended up having matches with Alex Wright. He was only in there for a few months before he left, but it wasn't the same thing. You know, the crazy guy on the undercard didn't work as well, you know, than Sabu, you know, main eventer in ECW who was doing the same stuff.
By the way, if you've never heard Sabu speak, check out Chris Jericho's podcast from a couple weeks ago where he is on there being interviewed for about 40 minutes.
Hmm.
And it's pretty interesting, actually. Another one of my favorites, and we, I don't know how we glossed over this, but Paul, he was like one of the first guys to bring the luchadors in from Mexico. And that first Psicosis and Rey Mysterio match, unbelievable. I mean, I had never seen anything like that in my life.
Is this the one where they went outside and they did the Horn Corrada off the car, or is this another one?
No, they had a series of matches.
Okay,
the
you're talking about
one,
the one where Psicosis won, right? See, I think he won the first one.
No. He didn't win the first one because the finish was a Hurricanrana off the top rope and then into the pin for the three. It was, oh man, it was so unreal because I had never seen anything like that in my life.
Yeah, those guys, they were like, it was kind of like they were like kind of replacements for like the Guerrero and Malenko stuff in the middle. You know, after those guys left, and so they brought the luchadors in. But I know Hoovy came in. Didn't Hoovy come in at one point? I know La Parca was there.
Yeah, Hoovy was there. And
yep.
But it was mainly just a Mysterio and a Psicosis. And they were coming off, you know, it was the year before when all those guys got some real big exposure when WCW did the When Worlds Collide pay-per-view. And,
yes.
In like 94. When they
yeah, like,
first saw all the guys in the United States.
Yeah, when I had heard that they had that those guys went to ECW, I was actually kind of excited because I had watched all that period in Mexico, that whole hot period, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw, you know, Eddie. I saw it before Eddie and Art even teamed. I remember when Art was still the babyface against the heel Blue Panther, and then they ended up doing the double turn. And then you had Super Calo and his partner Winners, who became like Abismo Negro. They were awesome. You know, Conan, Eddie, Perro Aguayo. I mean, that Mexico was just so awesome for like a few years. And then, like, right after that pay-per-view, it's like they lost TV or something. And I just couldn't see him anymore. And then when I heard they were, like, in ECW, I was like, damn, that's pretty cool. And then luckily WCW brought him in. And they didn't bury them right off the start. They gave them – they had, you know, a run where they were still kind of – people took them seriously. It took them they didn't kill them right away, you know. Unfortunately, that's what ended up happening. But, you know, it was cool getting to watch the Luchas have their matches in WCW for a while.
And Conan was actually, I was going to say, Conan was on the top of the cards in ECW, roughly the likes of Sandman. And I don't believe he had as many matches as Ray and Psychosis,
really,
but they had all come
ECW,
in with Conan.
Did he? He didn't really get over in ECW, did he? Like the other guys did.
No. I remember watching Conan and Sandman in a match, and it was the most blatant blade job I've ever seen in my life. They were trading Singapore cane shots, and Conan got the upper hand. And as he's selling, he's on his feet getting caned in the head, and you see Sandman reach into his pocket, cane to the head, and then take his hand and run it across his forehead, and then another cane to the head, and then he did it again, and then another cane to the head, and he did it again. It was just the worst blatant blade job I've ever seen in my life.
Well, the Sandman ain't no Tommy Wildfire Rich, that's for damn sure.
Oh my goodness. I can still see his ridiculous selling and then him, you know, gigging his head.
That sounds even more obvious than that one time Hogan gigged in front of everybody.
I don't remember that.
There was a match where Hogan gigged right there where the camera was on him.
Oops.
If it wasn't for Dave Meltzer and, you know, his reporting, I mean, I wonder how we'd look at Conan as, you know, most of us, I think, you know, grew up on mostly American wrestling. Mm-hmm. You know, I know all of us branched out later, but...
I did see the whole Conan thing in Mexico, so I knew he was like a star coming in, so...
But for most of us, right, I mean, for him to be the equivalent, the Mexican equivalent, I guess, of like a Hulk Hogan, you know, we only saw him as the American equivalent of Conan, which was not the same thing. So luckily, you know, that's the importance of, you know, wrestling journalists, wrestling historians like Dave Meltzer, who's able to document the exact importance of Conan, because that's something, you know, a lot of fans who only saw him in America may not understand. You know, this guy had a huge career before he came over. And was, you know, in okay matches. You know, I can't really think of too many Conan matches that really stood out they had in America, you know?
Mm-hmm. I was going to say Conan took that whole ECW style and took it back to Mexico with him. I don't know if you ever saw any of the tapes from AAA when they were having these barbed wire cage matches with the luchadors. It was crazy.
Yeah, but that's when Mexico actually started to start sucking after that for a while. And it took a few years before they kind of came back. But yeah, Conan, like I said, I saw him, you know, I knew he was a star. And then, like, before I even seen him, before that hot period in Mexico, he did that, what was the tournament that he was in with Rey Mysterio Sr.?
Starrcade 91.
And then he wrestled on Saturday night a few times. And that's when I first kind of, like, was, like, impressed by him. And then, you know, I watched that whole run in Mexico.
The Pat O'Connor International Tag Team Tournament in 1990, which actually Rocco Rock was in that tournament. He was one of the South Africans in that tournament.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He was one of the South Africans, yeah. But I wanted to, before we run out of time, I was going to ask you guys, who saw Paul Heyman go fucking crazy on Bix on Twitter the other day and just make him look like a total dumbass.
that was like a second encounter, right? Like, Bix and Paul Heyman have gotten into it on Twitter before, right?
I thought I was looking at a thread I read maybe a year or two ago.
It was on the board. I thought it was the same thread somebody just bumped.
What's funny, though, is because the few people who, like, kind of took to Bix's defense, and they're like, oh, well, Paul Lee didn't answer the question. It's like, Paul Lee doesn't have to answer the fucking question. Who the fuck is Bix? Bix doesn't know when Paul Lee has to answer. They don't realize that fucking Paul Lee, all he did was just troll Bix. He wasn't skirting the question because he didn't have to answer the question to Bix. You know what I mean? So everyone, oh, Bix, and then what's funny is, like, the whole time Robert's trying to get involved and he's fucking saying shit. So finally Paul Lee fucking says something back to Robert, and then Robert doesn't say shit. And then Robert tells the people, oh, I successfully trolled him. No, Robert, he fucking trolled you. He trolled you and he shut you up and you didn't say a goddamn thing after. So trying to act like you fucking trolled Paul Heyman. That was the best day because Paul Heyman trolled Robert and he trolled Bix and he made Bix look like a fucking idiot. And I'm sorry, but Brian, but you're fucking hurting the website by turning so much responsibility over to Bix. He's fucking reporting ha-ha bullshit as fact in the Figure Four Weekly when he could have just checked and saw that, no, Brock Lesnar wasn't wrestling the Bix show. And then he's got to put his opinion on the daily update. I like reading Dave's opinion when he adds his opinion or Brian's opinion because I even somewhat respect Brian. I really respect Dave. But when Bix is trying to throw his opinion, it's like, who the fuck are you? You're a fucking wannabe. Fucking trying to fucking do everything you can to get into good graces and move yourself up. You're fucking nobody, dude. And it pisses me off that he's doing the update. And then, like, when he said, oh, if you're an indie promoter, just send me a link because it's too much. You can't copy and paste a few sentences? God damn, you're fucking as lazy as Brian. Sooner or later, Bix is going to have somebody else do the update for him because he's too goddamn lazy to do it.
This rant coming from Ed is phenomenal.
In the hypocrisy?
I'm sure there's a few words you could throw in there like a Mad Lib.
I like Bix. I like him. I like his writing. So I don't have no problem with him.
You know, when Bix did that piece where he got the legal documents surrounding Ultimate Warrior's lawsuit with WWF and was able to do something that even garnered Dave's attention. So you must give him kudos for that, Edward Laredo, if you can't say anything else nice about the fella.
The only thing I can say nice about Bix is that one line on Wrestling Xavier fucking Live where he said, what do you want me to talk about, pride or something?
It seems to come around to hate everybody that does Wrestling Observer Live co-host. I don't know what the deal is there.
Don't even bring that up because he really sucked on that.
Well, I'm not going to say anybody sucked on audio.
That's right.
It's official.
I guess we should start to talk about the demise of ECW.
One thing I wanted to bring up real quick was, like, I think the most hated moment I ever saw in ECW was when Shane Douglas grabbed Gary Wolfe by the halo. You remember that?
Yeah, that was, looking back, that is very uncomfortable. You know, because he could have, I mean, he hurt him in real life. I'm sure it was an accident. I'm sure he didn't mean to hurt him when it happened.
Yeah.
But then you grab the guy's fucking halo and he swings him around. Now, I don't know, was the halo still totally attached? Was it a gimmick or was it still like there?
It was a gimmick.
Goddamn head together.
Yeah, he retired like a few months later to wrestling again. I just remember.
I have a question.
When he grabbed it, I remember just Joey Styles sounded like he was having some kind of spell in the broadcast booth. He didn't say anything. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I have a question for Craig about that. Craig, as someone who did professional wrestling, what are your thoughts on that bump Gary Wolf took on the DDT on the belt? I've seen guys in their first month take a forward roll like that, and none of them had broken necks. So it always was funny to me that he broke his neck on seemingly a nothing-looking bump.
Well, I was always under the impression that the whole halo thing was a gimmick. I had always heard that he had hurt his neck and strained his neck, but he didn't actually have a halo in. And when I got in my accident, they actually put a halo around my leg. and it was actually screwed into the bones. There was no screws inside of Gary Wolf's head. So, I mean, he did a great job selling that. And where do you get a halo for a gimmick? I have no idea. So it's not like you roll into the nearest hospital and say, hey, can we borrow this for the evening? But, I mean, if anybody could do it, it'd be Paul Heyman. But yeah, that was just a dumb bump. I mean, God love the guy, but that was dumb. I mean, I've seen
Van
Damme.
It was like a single-arm DDT kind of move,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Basically, yeah. I mean, you've all seen Van Damme take these ridiculous pile drivers or DDTs where he lands. Yeah, he lands straight on top of his head, and he bounces up like you had just bounced on a pogo stick.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I've never seen a guy take a bump like that.
Luckily for him, the ECW ring had more give than any other ring I've ever seen in my life.
And more give and more duct tape all over it.
Like a trampoline, the way he took the, like when he took the DDT, the ring almost like trampolined him up straight up, you know what I mean?
Guys, I'd like to thank you so much for having me on. It's been an honor. I'm still offended, Ed, that you didn't call me and consult with me, but clearly you've not read up on your ECW history, and maybe you should get with Bit next time, then get with me, and then we'll be able to set you straight on your ECW history. But I'd like to thank you guys for letting me on. It's great talking to you guys. I actually have a show to do at OnlineWorldWrestling.com with Ben Miller, so I'm excited to do that show. And it was
Jesus
great talking
Christ,
to you guys.
Two blowhards that are going to spew their stupid opinions for an hour. Oh my God!
You should talk about blowhard.
Tell Ben I said hello to.
We've been doing this for like 6 years. Blowhards found their opinion.
Who are you talking about? Because I'm not a blowhard.
Okay. Keep believing that, and you'll get along fine.
But, actually, God damn it, I hate when this happens. I actually had something I was going to bring up, but now I forgot it again.
We were talking about the demise of ECW.
Oh, I know. Let's talk about Joey Styles, because if the modern announcers, to me, Joey Styles is the best after Jim Ross. I mean, I'm not including the Lance Russells or the Bill Mercers, those type of guys. But, you know, this, like, last era or whatever, Joey Styles, to me, was awesome. And I almost kind of wish it was Jim Ross and Joey Styles calling the New Japan pay-per-view at the Tokyo Dome coming up. I think that would be awesome. Joey Styles was great. And then he did most of it by himself, which is he had to talk the whole time by himself. That's kind of hard to do, so he deserves some credit for that. I always like Joey Styles and his, oh, my God.
Yeah, I liked when he got hired when he came to WWF or WWE and started doing Raw. You know, some people didn't like it. I thought he was a good announcer on Raw and stuff
Michael
like
Cole,
that.
That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I just didn't like
that.
That
one time, that was
I like. I just always prefer like two commentators. Have one guy play off the other one. I never really liked just like a single commentator. But Joey Styles, he was very good. Yes.
I think Joey Styles. I think Joey is one of the most underrated. Not just promo guys, but just a commentator in general. I mean, his facial reactions, just everything about him. He's just absolutely tremendous. And to know that he was pulled out of basically a office, just awesome. He was absolutely great.
And he was working for Pro Wrestling Illustrated or something in their offices, I think. I recall when he started doing ECW.
I don't have no idea.
Pretty sure he was. I think I remember reading that somewhere. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, going back to, well, let me throw out the plugs real quick because we're almost out of my time. Everyone check out AngryMarks.com. You can always download and stream our show at AngryMarks.com along with a lot of other shows. Check out AngryMarks.com. You can also stream and download our show at blogtalkradio.com/Cotrere and order shows at blogtalkradio.com/Edward-Laredo. You can follow me at Facebook at Edward Laredo, and you can follow me at Twitter at Ed in San Antonio.
And you can follow me on Twitter. It's my last name, Proper, P-R-O-P-E-R, with the word jam after it. So Proper Jam on Twitter. Anything wrestling or music-related, I do on that site.
YouTube.com/Cotrere. If you want to watch some Eddie Gilbert, go up there because I got a bunch of Memphis playlists up there, so you can watch a bunch of great stuff from like late 70s and early to mid-80s. So.
Do you
have
the Tommy Rich angle on there?
Somewhere up there. You just type it into the search engine on YouTube and it'll pop right up probably.
Okay. But I guess like last, before we should go, we should talk about the demise of ECW. And basically, what happened was, and I think this happened to a lot of businesses, especially like local businesses that are doing really good, and then they start to expand, and they expand so fast that they can't keep up, and it ultimately ends to their demise, because ECW had, they were doing great crowds, they were on pay-per-view, you know, they, like I think Shane Douglas described it, he's like, we'd wrestle in front of 50 people, and the checks always cleared, and then we're wrestling in front of thousands of people, and all these people on pay-per-view and these big arenas, and then the checks start bouncing. And basically they just got bigger or too big than they really should have, demise, because they couldn't keep up with the demands of paying for everything. And then getting on TV, you would think it would be like a great thing. It ended up being the thing that probably hurt them the most, actually. You know?
Yeah.
And then when Spike decided they didn't want him anymore, they wanted WWE, and they couldn't get a TV deal, you know, that was pretty much the end of it, because unlike TNA, Paulie was smart and realized without real TV, there's no point in having it because you're just going to lose money. And probably what the Carter should have done is just ended TNA, but now they're going to a channel that probably, I don't even know if I get it, so, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
they're just going to lose.
I'm pretty sure I get it. Not that I'm going to partake in watching it, but I get it.
Yeah, so they're just going to slowly, like, lose more and more money,
like,
and just die a very long, painful death.
It seems like the things started kind of going down here, not only, like, just, like, financial-wise, but also a little bit creatively, like, when they started doing, when they first went to pay-per-view. Seems like they kind of started the downward spiral for ECW, in my opinion, anyway.
I think he just got too overworked. You know, he was trying to do all these other things, and it took away from his creativity. And then plus, they did, the talent-wise, really went down. You know what I mean? Because they lost so many guys. You know, they lost the Dullies.
It was looking just like a, just like a regular independent show. Like at the end.
I mean, for a while, what, weren't the top fucking heels just incredible on Lance Storm?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
but maybe they're like in 1999 for a little while there.
And then
I think it was like Steve Corino and Rhino were like the last two really main heels there or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were like two of the main ones. I remember Corino, you know, was getting the most push he ever got at the time.
I remember he went off, he went all, you remember when he cut that promo on the network, on his show, he talked about how horrible his network was.
Dude, I dare you to
kick
me off your
station.
That was actually awesome.
They promote ECW. They show the commercials for ECW while the ECW show is playing, which
that's like that's like on the network. They advertise a pay-per-view. If you're already watching it, you know we're gonna watch the pay-per-view.
You know, they advertise the pay-per-view or tell you, and the people that are watching the pay-per-view tell you how stupid you are for watching the pay-per-view instead of the network.
Your thoughts on the end of ECW, Craig?
It was a slow and painful death. It really was. I mean, it was like they were on TNN for a while, and that's when I, you know, actually could actually watch it. You know, I mean, it came over on Fox Sports 1 for a few weeks here in Washington State, and then it, you know, got bumped over to TNN, the Nashville network. What ECW was doing on that Nashville network, I never know. Paulie was a genius in stating that, you know, there was a corporation that was pushing him to do Tamer Television. So they were like the man, and he was rebelling against the man. The man was TNN at the time. But I got really disinterested in the programming because it just wasn't what it used to be.
Yeah.
You know, checks started bouncing, people started leaving, and their top draws were, you know, taken off. And
basically, all they had at the end was RVD, and then he got hurt.
He had just come back at that point, I think, because he had broken his leg and was out for like 9 months. And they were about to start with him against Mike Awesome for the, like, the world title. And then Mike Awesome, he went to WCW, and they brought Taz back from WWF to be the WCW guy for the ECW title.
That's right.
That was funny.
And then Triple H fucking had to job him and Dreamer out on Raw or SmackDown.
Well, it's okay if Dreamer just dropped out. Don't matter. He was all the time.
But hey, I was really glad they, you know, they did the one night stand pay per views. I think those were absolutely
that first one was like one of the best pay per views I've ever seen.
It was awesome. Yeah.
Except Chris Jericho shouldn't have done the job the last storm.
Yeah,
I don't think he cared.
No, he didn't care.
Yeah.
And look at that match with Masato Tanaka and Awesome. Jesus Christ.
That was awesome.
Ridiculous.
They had awesome matches.
Oh, my God. That was a bit too much.
I'll never understand.
Never understand what?
How he's not brain dead right now.
Well, one of them is dead, but anyway.
Well, I'm talking about Masato Tanaka. And he still looks good. I mean, you saw him at the hotel and at Mania, right, Craig?
I didn't see him. I saw him at the hotel. I didn't see him work.
Well, that's what I meant. You know, he stayed at our hotel, and he looked pretty decent.
Yeah.
We actually are getting a caller here on the line. You want to take him before we go?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a caller calling from area code 661.
What? Hello?
Yeah, hello. Are you on here?
Yeah, I think I am.
Yeah, well, what do you want to talk about?
Boy.
Are you stoned?
What?
Are you stoned?
What is that?
All right, you're out of here. I mean, if you're going to call into a radio show, at least be ready to start asking questions or something.
My goodness.
And Couture hung up, or maybe I hung up on Couture and the other guy had hung up before. Oh, well.
Play the music.
All right, let me play the music here. Everyone come back next week. We'll talk to everybody then.